Hi, this is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Dr. Oscar Radoli, bringing you the best mix of music.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss former President Jimmy Carter's record and legacy on human rights, including the Enduring Carter Center.
Human rights journalist Misha Garagoulis from the Project Censor joins us to discuss the model that Jimmy Carter established for U.S. foreign policy.
We also speak with Norman Solomon, who's just reissued his great book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine.
His new afterword to the book focuses on the corporate media's biased coverage of the Israeli-U.S. war in Gaza.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Jimmy Carter passed away on December 29, 2024, at the age of 100. His legacy in human rights has left an indelible mark on global diplomacy. Elected in 1977, Carter made human rights a central theme of his administration. He believed that as a global power, the U.S. had a responsibility to champion freedom, dignity, and justice for all people, regardless of nationality or political system. This vision led to the introduction of policies aimed at addressing both the internal injustices within the U.S. and the broader human rights violations occurring around the world. One of Carter's most significant achievements in this realm was condemning authoritarian regimes and promoting democratic movements. His administration applied pressure on governments, particularly in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, to uphold human rights standards, often linking U.S. foreign aid and diplomatic relations to a country's record on human rights. Though controversial at times, especially in relation to U.S. alliances with regimes like those in Iran and Egypt, Carter's commitment to human rights was revolutionary in its directness. The Carter Center, founded in 1982, became a beacon for promoting democracy, advancing health, and improving human rights globally. Through the center, Carter monitored elections, mediated peace talks, and worked to eliminate diseases that disproportionately affected the world's most vulnerable populations. After leaving office, Carter's work as a human rights advocate set a new standard for U.S. foreign policy, showing that human rights can be a priority in shaping international relations and peace efforts. Joining us today is human rights editor and writer Misha Garagoulis. She is the curriculum development coordinator for Project Censored and author of the forthcoming book to be published by Routledge, Media Framing and the Destruction of Cultural Heritage. Misha, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Heidi, it's my pleasure. Thank you to you and to Steve for having me.
And it's wonderful, actually, that we're recording on the National Day of Mourning for Jimmy Carter. Carter is often regarded as one of the most human rights-focused U.S. presidents. What first inspired his dedication to this cause?
You know, Heidi, Carter had campaigned on the intention to restore trust in the office of the U.S. president and to improve diplomacy and foreign policy by operating within the universal human rights framework, which also factored into another campaign promise, which was to make government more competent and compassionate. He entered the presidency on the heels of Watergate, the Vietnam War, these global events that spotlighted egregious human rights abuses. as well as spotlighted the U.S.'s loss of integrity, both globally and domestically. So I'd say those factors, combined with his ideals, his Christian faith, and deep belief in democracy, all played a role in inspiring his mission to center human rights in U.S. policies and conduct.
During his presidency, how did Carter's human rights policies differ from those of previous presidents?
That's a great question, Steve. I think that from the beginning of his campaign that had garnered popular support around both civil rights and human rights, the expectation from the get-go was that Carter was going to be different. He really worked to align the White House agenda with the UN 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights and to align the international human rights movement with the more national civil rights movement. What was different about that was that Carter was bringing this human rights conversation, one that had been more prevalent in the international realm, into more mainstream American discourse. He then worked to integrate human rights and democracy more into U.S. foreign affairs. An important piece of that work actually came under the purview of the State Department when he established what in 1977 was called the Bureau of Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs. Today, it goes by the name Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Affairs. One of the tasks of the Bureau was to publish annual country reports on human rights practices, essentially disclosing the status of civil, individual, political, and worker rights within nations around the world. There was already a law in the books for making those reports, which had been established under Kennedy's Foreign Assistance Act of 1961. But the first country report was not actually published until 1977 under Carter. And those reports have been forthcoming ever since. Another key difference in the Carter administration was the break from the policy of realpolitik, the conventional wisdom that said if a country is pro-American, it really doesn't matter how they treat their own citizens. Carter changed that by calling out the human rights abuses of ally nations as well as adversaries, which was different and also controversial.
Misha, can you explain some of the key human rights issues Carter addressed during his time in office?
Carter brought his religious faith and ideologies to the State for Human Rights, which was a fairly new position that had been created as part of that Kennedy-era Foreign Assistance Act. Carter's choice was striking in that he chose a woman, and he chose someone who had no foreign policy experience. Patricia Darien, however, had been entrenched in civil rights work, and she took the work of human rights very seriously and became instrumental in elevating the human rights mission. On the domestic front, Carter approached issues of race, gender, housing, healthcare, energy, the environment, climate, all as human rights issues. And then he looked at those same issues, or some of those same issues, in other nations. And on the international front, he publicly recognized the epic failures of Vietnam. He pointed out Pinochet's torturous human rights abuses in Chile, the disappearances in Argentina. He spoke about the negative consequences of fossil fuel and of course, foreign oil dependence, and sought to condition foreign agreements with adherence to human rights norms.
Iran played a pivotal role in his presidency. How did human rights factor into U.S. relations with Iran during the Carter administration?
That's such a tricky question. The background to that is that when Carter came into office, among his other aims, he wanted to clean house at the CIA and the FBI and, as you said, focused foreign policy toward human rights and democracy. Before 1979, the U.S. had a strategic relationship with Iran. Iran was a true ally. And then Carter made a visit to Tehran to meet with Shah Pahlavi. And during that visit, many, not Americans, but Iranians rather, were expecting Carter to call out the Shah on his regime's human rights abuses. Carter, however, made a mistake during that visit, and it was when he was having dinner with the Shah, he made a toast and said something to the effect of, he congratulated the Shah on having an island of stability in this unstable region, the Middle East. And when many Iranian citizens heard that, they lost trust in Carter. He didn't do what they were expecting him to do. On Carter's side, this visit to Iran came after four Arab-Israeli wars, the Organization of Arab Petroleum Extracting Countries oil embargo of 1973, the Nixon shock, stagflation in the U.S., factors that had sort of given a more favorable impression of Iran. But then, as we know, that visit totally backfired. And then the 444-day hostage situation was essentially payback to Carter for what the Iranians considered his betrayal.
Misha, what was the role of the U.S. in Carter's approach, as you briefly referred to earlier, to Latin American human rights, especially in the context of military dictatorships?
I think even before becoming president, he felt a duty towards Latin America. On the campaign trail and during debates, Carter had called out President Ford, for example, for failing to condemn the 1973 coup in Chile. So when he became president, there was already this law on the books, part of that Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 that I mentioned, for conditioning foreign aid on adherence to human rights. However, previous presidents were not sticking to that. Until Carter, administrations had been willing to look the other way when it came to aiding U.S. allies who violated human rights with their own citizens. So Carter became the first president to actually adhere to that Foreign Assistance Act, which put human rights very openly at the center of Latin American policies. He moved toward stopping the unilateral approach to Latin America that was so focused on Soviet containment. But not entirely, obviously, as he made missteps in Nicaragua and El Salvador. Nevertheless, he did take important steps with other countries, like by cutting aid to Guatemala in 1977 during the Mayan genocide. Carter cut aid to Videla's Argentina, leading to Argentina's agreement to receive a visit from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in 1978. Which then led to a decrease in disappearances in the country. And on that note, it's worth mentioning that Carter's Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, Patricia Derian, she became really fixated on Argentina, and she later testified at Argentina's 1985 trials against the former military leaders. Uruguay is another example. Uruguay had wanted more normalized relations with the U.S., and so Carter conditioned that possibility on them improving their human rights record. He cut loans and funding to Uruguay and utilized diplomacy, which later contributed to the country's transition toward democracy and release of political prisoners. Carter put sanctions on Chile, which helped to put pressure on the Pinochet regime, and reportedly state-sponsored killings in Chile decreased during Carter's presidency, but then spiked again during the Reagan years. Carter is basically credited with putting the former right-wing dictatorships of Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, and Brazil on a path toward democracy. He was also accused of double standards on his human rights and non-interventionist stance, mostly owing to the continuation of those Cold War anti-communist pursuits.
Misha, let's turn and focus even more on the Middle East. How did Carter's approach to human rights intersect with his decision to support and develop the Camp David Accords in 1978?
Carter's understanding of Christian social justice and his belief in the sanctity of the Holy Land played an important role in his decision to intervene in that conflict between Israel and Egypt. Up to that point, there had been four wars between Israel and Egypt, Suez Canal closures, and violence around the region. Carter believed that he could use his position as a U.S. president to negotiate peace between the two nations that each, as it happened, wanted closer relations with the U.S. You know, as we know, the accords were largely considered a success. Israel withdrew from the Sinai Peninsula, which offered more regional stability and kept the Suez Canal open. And though, to be fair, the accords are criticized for concluding to the exclusion of the Palestinian question. So I guess more to your question, human rights played a role, and yet there were compromises.
Well, speaking of Palestine, in 2006, Carter published the book Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Can you touch on his concerns about emerging apartheid?
Yes. So Carter borrowed that term, apartheid, that was used in South Africa to describe the policies of racial separation in South Africa from 1948 to 1990 to make a point. Carter, in the book, defined the term as the forced separation of two peoples in the same territory, with one of the groups dominating or controlling the other. The book goes on to discuss the system of ethnic segregation in the West Bank, in which Palestinians and Israeli Jews live under a two-tiered legal system that gives Israeli Jewish settlers all the privilege and protection of citizenship, yet deprives Palestinians of their most basic human rights. In the early 2000s, just as Carter was thinking about this book, Israel began construction of a giant wall throughout the West Bank to separate Palestinians from Israel and from Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Israel calls the wall a security barrier, and human rights organizations around the world call it an apartheid wall. Until that book, no president had applied that term, apartheid, to Israel's control over the Palestinians in the West Bank. And unsurprisingly, he was labeled anti-Semitic, which is unfair and unwarranted, because Carter believed so deeply in the sanctity of the Holy Land and really held to this dream of peace. He felt that the book, or he intended for the book to be a warning as to basically what's happening today. It was more a warning than a condemnation, because he was pro-Israel too. And here we are 19 years later, Carter's assertion in the book that peace would only happen if Israel, with U.S. backing, would at bare minimum return the land that it illegally began occupying after 1967 and stop its dehumanization of Palestinians.
If you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and with my co-host Stephen Rohde, we're interviewing human rights editor and author Misha Giraculis.
Misha, one of Carter's major achievements after his presidency was the founding of the Carter Center. What are some of its major contributions to global human rights? Many people think of it as a domestic foundation working on Habitat for Humanity, but has a huge global reach.
Absolutely, and that's actually near and dear to my heart. The work of the Carter Center is overarchingly in service to the greater good of humanity, concentrating on issues in human rights, democracy, freedom, conflict resolution, and health and well-being. The center was conceived of as a way for both Mr. and Mrs. Carter to further the work that they considered their life's mission. To give you a few examples of that global human rights work, they very actively support the UN International Declaration of Human Rights, the Office of the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights, the UN Human Rights Council, as well as human rights defenders and activists around the world on initiatives in gender rights, environmental rights, racial and social and climate justice, and democratic elections. One thing that I find very interesting is that every year the Carter Center conducts an international human rights defenders forum, which brings together heads of state, activists, community and religious leaders, leaders of governmental and non-governmental organizations together at the Carter Center to provide a safe space for these leaders to discuss the human rights challenges in their own countries. In 2018, at the 70th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, I attended the two-day summit at the Carter Center as an observer journalist. The summit itself is set up very similar to a UN meeting. When I was there, it was moderated by President Carter and by the UN Assistant Secretary General for the High Commissioner for Human Rights at the time, Andrew Gilmore. And when I was there, I would say there were approximately 40 nations represented. One of the more significant actions that come from these yearly forums is that when Mr. and Mrs. Carter were both alive, now it's representatives from the Carter Center, they would travel to countries for private meetings or send letters or make phone calls to heads of state on behalf of whomever had pled their cause at the forum to appeal for human rights protection or whatever that case might warrant. And then you mentioned Habitat for Humanity. That's so worthwhile to bring up. That's actually separate from the work of the Carter Center, but the Carters, Mr. and Mrs. Carter, worked for 40 years as a volunteer building houses in like 14 different countries, as well as across the United States.
Now that both Carters have passed away, has the Carter Center been sufficiently institutionalized? Do you anticipate it will be able to continue its good work after the loss of Rosalynn and Jimmy Carter?
I would certainly imagine that their legacy is thoroughly secured within the center. It has so much support locally. It's a mainstay in Atlanta. It works hand in hand with Emory University on their health initiatives. The Carter Center's health initiatives are entrenched in something like 80 countries around the world. I don't see any of that going away.
Speaking of health initiatives, can you briefly discuss how the Carter Center was involved in guinea worm disease?
Yeah, that's so interesting. That is a disease that has long been considered a neglected tropical disease. It's, or some people refer to it as an ancient disease. And so it's one that Jimmy Carter himself wanted to take on. The Carter Center spearheaded this massive project to eradicate the guinea worm starting in 1986. At that stage, the numbers were like 3.5 million human cases per year in the 21 countries where it's found, mainly in Africa and Asia. Animals are also infected, but the Carters started working with humans first. They partner, and this continues, they partnered with national ministries of health and local communities and would send teams, and Mr. and Mrs. Carter themselves would go as well. Teams would go to these different countries to provide health education intervention strategies. And then the Carter Center stays very active to help maintain political will in the nation to continue the health program, the guinea worm eradication program. Up to date, or as of 2024, the guinea worm disease has purportedly been reduced by 99%.
Wow, that is a real accomplishment. So the picture is not all good in the sense that critics of Carter argue that he sometimes overlooked human rights violations when so-called strategic interests were at stake. You've mentioned some compromises he made along the way. In a overall sense, do you think those criticisms are fair?
You know, Steve, I think anyone in the office of the presidency or in any position of leadership in a democracy deserves appropriate scrutiny and to be held accountable. That's the work of the Fourth Estate. So critical analyses are necessary. And I think it's certainly fair to say that Carter made some consequential mistakes, which I think he mostly owned over the course of his years. His peacemaker or kind of Sunday school teacher approach to Latin American dictators was seen as naive or too friendly, which led to, you know, some real tragedies. He was said to be overly trusting of the Soviets and miscalculated or never saw coming the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. He clearly made missteps with Iran, and the hostage situation was a total fiasco, even though it did later come to light that his negotiations with the Ayatollah were actually useful. He was criticized for yielding control to the Panama Canal to Panama because the Panamanian government was not sufficiently democratic. Another criticism is around the Khmer Rouge. Carter verbally called out their human rights abuses but took no action. After Vietnam, there was no political will, there was no military will to return to Southeast Asia. And then, you know, his crisis of confidence speech was largely a miss, because most of the American people, I think, misunderstood it or got angry. And Carter, you know, being a Washington outsider, he didn't play politics the way it was expected. And he didn't play to the camera. He was a visionary with well-intentioned ideas and ideals, but it didn't always translate on the ground.
Misha, as we consider Carter's overall legacy, what do you think future leaders can learn from his commitment to human rights, especially in today's world?
Wow, that's a great question. Carter, throughout his life, managed to maintain a deep belief in the sanctity of all of life, including that of the planet itself. He brought a moral and social consciousness to the office of the presidency and made human rights a real presidential imperative. Because of Carter, human rights, at least on paper, are considered integral to foreign policy. And every president, except for Trump, has seemed to make some effort toward adhering to that. You know, in this era where there's so much backward movement on civil society and democracy, the incoming president and leaders everywhere could turn things around by emulating Carter's stance on universal human rights, on social justice and climate justice. He was a proponent of using diplomacy and cooperation over force and coercion. And I mean, that was to his political demise, but I think that other leaders could take a page from that book. I believe that the mark of a true leader is found in someone who puts the greater good before their own self-interests, and Carter embodied that.
Misha, how can listeners follow your work and the work of Project Censored?
Thank you so much for asking. I can be found at Project Censored, which is projectcensored, all one word, .org. Our work is spelled out there all over the website, and we're on social media, and we have a YouTube channel and a radio show, the Project Censored Show. And I personally have a Muckrack page.
On today's National Day of Mourning, it has been an utter pleasure to discuss Carter's legacy on human rights. Thank you so much, and let's stay in touch.
Oh, Heidi, Steve, it's been my absolute honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The United States is engaged in constant, if often invisible, wars. Or if not invisible, at least not accurately and fully reported on in the corporate media, thereby leaving the people of the United States far from fully informed as to what and where U.S. military troops are stationed or engaged in military action. For example, while there has been a great deal of media coverage of the U.S.-supported Israeli war in Palestine, one would have needed to pay extra close attention to that coverage to know that the U.S., even before that war began, had 40,000 U.S. troops stationed in the area, or that the Biden administration has just recently sent at least 1,500 more to join them. And how many of us know that late last year, retired Israeli Major General Yitzhak Brick said that, and I quote, "All of our missiles, the ammunition, the precision-guided bombs, all the airplanes that bombs, it's all from the U.S. Everyone understands that we, Israel, can't fight this war without the United States, period." So last year, Norman Solomon, our guest today, wrote a much-noted and much-admired book titled War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And that book has now been re-released with an updated afterword by the author all about the Gaza War and the press. Naomi Klein, best-selling author of The Shock Doctrine, says the book is a, and again I quote, a staggeringly important intervention. Noam Chomsky says Solomon's book is, quote, a gripping and painful study of the mechanisms behind our invisible but perpetual national state of war. Now, Norman Solomon is the co-founder of RootsAction.org and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and is, in fact, the author or co-author of at least 12 books, most touching on today's topic in either close or tangential ways. Well, Norman Solomon, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks so much.
And Norman, today we're going to, well, focus on your contention that the U.S. media has not and is not reporting on the U.S.-Israeli war in Gaza in a way that could be called balanced or fair. In the new afterword to your book, you identify a half dozen ways in which this pro-Israeli bias shows itself. So let's talk about some of these indicators of the media bias. For example, you claim that the U.S. media failed to hold the U.S. accountable for its high-tech atrocities committed from the air, and second, that it has failed to hold the U.S. government accountable for the slaughter of civilians in Gaza. And Norman, you also make the point that studies have shown that the media refers to the deaths of Israelis in the conflict far more sympathetically than they do the deaths, and in far, far greater numbers, sadly, of the Palestinians. So talk to us about all of this.
We've really had a chronic pattern that has gone on throughout this century, where first after 9/11, the launch of the so-called War on Terror has been followed by now 23 years of U.S. media coverage where the victims of U.S. bombing have been abstractions, occasional feature stories, occasional numbers that are thrown into news accounts. But basically, when the U.S. has been killing civilians, that has been pretty much a inconsequential or very played down aspect of media news reporting and commentary. Whereas, of course, the suffering, the deaths, the mourning, the losses of American soldiers from Iraq to Afghanistan have been pretty much exalted into the kind of empathetic coverage that should exist, which is to value all human lives, not just some human lives that are part of the United States military operation or among its allies. And unfortunately, that same pattern, the imbalance of media coverage, has really played out in terms of now into its second year, the Israeli war in Gaza. And this isn't just anecdotal. We know from actual studies, for instance, by the media outlet The Intercept, the words used to describe the suffering of Israelis killed by Hamas on October 7th, 2023, have been very empathetic and very emotional. So let's take the word slaughter. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times used the word slaughter 60 different times to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis on October 7th. But those same media outlets used the word slaughter only once to describe what had been done in the first 6 weeks of the war on Gaza to the Palestinians. And that's just in the first month and a half of the war. This kind of imbalance really conveys to the public in the United States that some lives really matter and some lives really don't.
Norman, related to what you just discussed, you also make the claim that mainstream discourse has avoided reporting on those who have condemned the U.S. government for its role in the slaughter of civilians. Do you mean by that that voices from the movement against what Israel and the U.S. is doing in Gaza? Or do you mean that it's not reporting on voices from the U.S. government speaking out against the war? Please explain.
We've had very little coverage about the content of the movement against the U.S.-backed Israeli war on Gaza. A lot of discussion, especially in the spring, of the campus movements, the demonstrations, the encampments, where thousands and thousands of students were active to demand an end to the U.S. government's support of the slaughter in Gaza. And so the quantity of coverage of protests was certainly very big. The quality of it was a whole other matter. very rarely did we actually hear from the protesters directly. They were talked about, they weren't heard from. And a lot of the coverage that did exist of their activities, and more broadly, protests around the country about the war on Gaza, the media coverage was often defamatory. It was negative. It said that these people were maybe misguided, uninformed, and or anti-Semitic, which was a real slander. Ironic, because a lot of those protests were led by Jewish people here in the United States.
And Norman, what about people in the U.S. government speaking out against the war? Was there any coverage of that?
There have been a number of people in the U.S. State Department and elsewhere in various agencies who have resigned explicitly in protest, often with very moving letters to the president or the secretary of state saying, I cannot abide remaining in this government while it supports genocide against people in Gaza, when most of the victims acknowledged to be now over 40,000, and that's an underestimate, being children and women. I cannot stay in this government. I am resigning in protest. And when that has happened, there has been some fleeting coverage. You would have an article in a daily newspaper, such as the New York Times and Washington Post. There might be an interview on CNN or another network, but very briefly. And the essence of a propaganda system is not the brief occasional, the exception. It's the routine. That's the essence of propaganda, and the framework and the assumptions and the overwhelming quantity and type of sources that are being quoted and cited. So unfortunately, even though these have often been very profound moral statements and people sacrificing their own careers in government to protest against this genocide, generally the U.S. news media have given those protests and those acts of conscience very short shrift.
And Norman Solomon, you also claim that the media generally portrays, reports, if you will, the deaths of in Gaza, of the Palestinians, as quote-unquote unintended, that claims by Israel that they were making good faith efforts to minimize civilian deaths, well, they go unchallenged. Talk to us about that.
That's a paradigm that has been just so consistent throughout the so-called U.S. war on terror in the last 23 years. And it has been accentuated, I think, even more egregiously in terms of the line that has come out from Washington and the Israeli government vis-a-vis the war in Gaza. It's really a cop-out, it's an excuse, and it's a standard way of trying to use words to blow away the realities of what these wars have been doing. The fact is, these deaths of civilians are entirely predictable, they are entirely foreseeable, and anybody who is at all conscious in a military hierarchy will know that when you drop these bombs on people in civilian areas, you're going to be killing a lot of children and women and other civilians. And yet the pretense is there. It's unintended. Therefore, it isn't something that we're culpable for, we're responsible for. And I give an analogy in the book of, let's say that some criminals are being chased in a downtown shopping area near where you live, and the police are spraying the front of the stores with machine gun fire and going up and down the street during the middle of the day, just firing willy-nilly at people because they say there are some criminals maybe in some of the stores. Well, the police could always say, oh, look, all these deaths, there are these dead bodies all over town. They're civilians, women and children, but we didn't intend it, so we're off the hook. That is preposterous. And then you add to that the very clear evidence the Israeli government is intentionally killing civilians. There is no doubt about it that this is a concerted effort, including even the use of 2,000-pound bombs in very heavily populated urban areas. This is a goal of the Israeli government. And if any listener is going to say, oh, that sounds anti-Semitic, by the way, I'm Jewish, and I understand what the ideology is operating now in terms of the policies in Israel. Add to that the fact that starvation is being used as a weapon of war by Israel. That has been true beginning in October of 2023. It has been verified by the United Nations, and it's a war crime. And the fact is that the United States has been supporting the Israeli government as it engages in methodical war criminality, including using the denial of food as a weapon of war.
Overall, in sum, perhaps in a sense, you claim that the news media, as well as the U.S. government officials, in broad strokes, have both displayed really a mindset that in sum shows that they believe Israeli lives, well, they matter a great deal more than do Palestinian lives. That's what this seems to be all about, doesn't it, Norman?
Well, very much. It's reflected in the way that the news media and those in political power in Washington use language and promote their policies. When the United States, and just in the last couple of months, has green-lighted about $25 billion with a B dollars, more weapons to the Israeli government while it engages in continued mass murder, mostly of civilians, in Gaza, what conclusions are we to draw? We could use an analogy. People may remember the terrible tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, where guns were sold to an unhinged young man who went out and slaughtered people at a school. And there were questions raised afterward. Well, the weapons were bought at a gun shop. How could the gun shop owner sell the weapons to this person? And the response was, well, the gun shop owner didn't know how the weapons were going to be used. In contrast, the president of the United States knew and has known how the weapons were being used and yet continued to send them. And that's where the clarity of the actual motivations and activities of the Israeli government should come into clear focus. This is something that has been dodged by the U.S. media. And I give an example in the book where in February of this year, after coming back from the border of Gaza and Egypt, the border of Gaza and Israel, Senator Van Hollen from Maryland gave a very moving speech on the Senate floor. And he said, the denial of food to starving people is a war crime, and the leaders of the Israeli government are war criminals. He said that point blank. And a few hours later, the same Senator Van Hollen voted to send $14 billion worth more of weapons to leaders he had just called war criminals. And this is the kind of doublethink involved that is so pernicious and makes the U.S. government an accomplice to mass murder and genocide.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. We're interviewing Norman Solomon about his new book. Norman, I wonder, do you perhaps also feel that the news media has gone out of its way to portray the slogans and demands of the pro-Palestinian movement on campuses and elsewhere as being largely and unquestionably anti-Semitic, and that they fail to cover the arguments as to why those slogans and demands are not anti-Semitic?
With very rare exceptions, that is the case. It is a reflex. It has been in place for decades when criticisms have been made of the Israeli government, and it has been greatly accentuated in the last 12 months. And it's really been a scam on a propaganda basis operated by the Israeli government and its supporters in the United States. This is the gist. For decades, Israel has been engaged in ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. It has been periodically killing thousands of civilians in Gaza. It has evicted so many Palestinians from their homes. And yet, whenever the apartheid system, and it is an apartheid system, in Israel gets publicly criticized, it is so often that the criticism is denounced as anti-Semitism. And the technique is, even though Israel is committing all of these crimes on a daily basis, these horrific policies against our fellow human beings, the Palestinians, when those policies are criticized, the Israeli government and its supporters wrap those crimes in the Jewish religion. And it's a basic, very fundamental newspeak, doublethink maneuver that we need to challenge directly.
You know, Norman, I'm wondering, when you think about the bias that you've just demonstrated and pointed out to us, a media monopoly pretty much in this country today, isn't it? Five major corporations owning the main sources of media that people are exposed to and have. It's a capitalist society. So long as that's the case, how realistic is it to think that one can effectively challenge this media bias around Israel and the war in Gaza or around anything else, frankly?
It's a pretty powerful corporate media wall, and yet the wall has cracks in it. And those cracks sometimes become very significant when we think about even the Iraq War, which was cheerled by U.S. corporate media. As protests grew and as people saw through the excuses for U.S. aggression on Iraq, public sentiment really changed. I think it's really dramatic and very telling that even though there has been an ongoing propaganda barrage in favor of Israel, and certainly intensified in the last year, the majority of people in the United States, according to polls, want an arms embargo against Israel. And I think that's quite remarkable. Despite the failure of people on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, whether in Congress or the White House, to actually speak clearly about these terrible atrocities being committed by the U.S.-backed Israeli military on a daily basis, most of the U.S. public, despite the media coverage, doesn't want the weapons to keep going to the Israeli military. And I think that goes to the fact that propaganda has its limits, and independent media outlets, including ones like we're speaking on today, when people take the initiative, they say, we're not going to be defeatist about this, we're realistic, but there are other messages, there are other voices that have to be heard, and that really can make a difference in the long run.
Norman Solomon, in the book, we've been talking about your latest and up-to-date afterward about the invisibility of and the bias of the media with respect to the war in the Middle East, the war in Israel and the waging in Gaza and so forth. But the book itself, I think, it makes the point in an overarching way that I'd like you to share with our audience. I mean, talk to us about how the extent of militarism in the United States, the number of military bases we have, the number of conflicts on a daily basis the U.S. military is involved in, either directly or in some kind of advice capacity. Talk to us about any number of aspects of what you write about so brilliantly in an invisibility of war, if you will, and how that ties in what we've been talking about thus far on the show.
Overseas, very few people in this country are aware that there are 750 U.S. military bases, and the impacts at home are rarely talked about. I mean, here we've gone through these horrible hurricanes of late, and the lack of resources to help people prepare and then recover from is just very flagrant. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about not only what he called the madness of militarism, but another phrase he called this military spending demonic, destructive suction tube that is just taking money away from what we need here at home. And that's as true in 2024 as it was when he talked about it in 1967. I think the invisibility of war is so crucial in terms of not only far away, we don't really know what the U.S. is doing, bombing and helping other militaries to engage in their activities, but the invisibility of war at home. And in terms of recent events, when I was earlier this year working on this paperback edition of War Made Invisible, I thought about, well, how does invisibility apply to what has been happening in Gaza? And it's very much the conceit in U.S. media that somehow if you watch the news, if you read your newspaper, that somehow you know, you see what war is about. And that very conceit accentuates the falsity and the misunderstanding. You know, there's that saying, it's not what people don't know that bothers me, it's what they know that just ain't so. And if we think we know what war is about because this news coverage is telling us, then it's a double whammy, because there are inherent limits to what journalism can convey about it's what it's really like to be in a war. War is about death. It's about terror. It's about maiming. And yet, in our news coverage, there's very little of that actually conveyed. And then another part of the invisibility in terms of the war on Gaza is that there's so much ethnic, religious, racial, and nationalistic bias that comes through. We've seen again and again how the Israelis who have suffered from Hamas attacks, they have been really treated with great empathy, as they should be. But it's relatively rare to have a personal kind of bit of coverage in terms of what Palestinian people are going through. And in terms of the title and subtitle of the book, I eventually got a handle on how War Made Invisible applies to what has been going on in Gaza. But then I thought about the subtitle, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And it became clear to me that the Israeli military is part of the U.S. military machine. There is a separate command structure, but more than ever we've seen since October of 2023 that the so-called Defense Department of the United States and the so-called Israel Defense Force are really operating in an integrated way. And I think that's very important because, again, militarism is so ubiquitous and pervasive in U.S. society at so many levels, politically, economically, psychologically, in terms of media, in terms of adulation of the U.S. military. And that really has bled over and merged into the adulation given to the Israelis as supposedly fighting for a democracy in the Middle East. How can you have democracy when, as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch have been documenting for years, that Israel is an apartheid state? So how can you have an apartheid state and still call it a democracy? One of the sort of gotcha questions that U.S. news media have been using very much during the war on Gaza is, do you think Israel has a right to exist? And we're all supposed to say yes. And my answer is, did apartheid South Africa have a right to exist? Does apartheid Israel have a right to exist? Or if we're going to have a single standard of human rights, should we not be calling for a country that is truly respectful of all human beings, rather than in practice, as Israel is doing, proceed as though some human beings are expendable?
Norman Solomon, you've written a very important book. People should get this book and read it, War Made Invisible. How can people get the book, and how can people follow your work?
A very easy way is just to go to the web, warmadeinvisible.org, and there'll be a lot of information there about the book. And also, my writing is on my website at normansolomon.com.
Well, Norman, once again, here on Law and Disorder, you've provided us with some information that certainly folks are not hearing on the mainstream media. And we thank you so much for bringing that untold story to all of our listeners.
Thanks a lot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges about his book, American Fascist. Is there still time to halt the growing fascistic movement in America and preserve a meaningful measure of our threatened democracy? Next, we look at what has happened to those nearly 800 men and boys who for over two decades now have been locked away in Guantanamo Bay prison. Wrongfully denied prisoner of war status, tortured and denied any meaningful due process, 30 of them still remain with no clear idea of when their fates will finally be decided.
Stay with us.
I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics, perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. His first 4 years in office were chaotic, uninformed programmatically, and not animated by any kind of cadre of capable administrators. It was instead full of his statements and actions that many critics deemed to be racist, sexist, and xenophobic. He lost the election in 2020, although he did receive 74 million votes. And as he runs for the presidency again, this time he is talking, well, rather openly about wanting dictatorial authority, if indeed he is elected. And this time, if he does win, he now also has the aid of the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which has produced that 900-page Project 2025 document on how to radically change our country so as to make it far, far more conservative, provide far fewer rights to the American people, and allow any president so inclined to run the country as a virtual dictator. He has the financial support of a number of billionaires. He has an authoritarian right-wing Supreme Court, which in its latest decision, aptly named Donald Trump versus the United States of America, has given the presidency carte blanche immunity and placed him above the law, allowing the president to do almost anything he or she might want to do as long as it's deemed to be an official presidential act. And so today's program is the lead-off to a series of shows about fascism. Experts will discuss what it is, how it can be resisted, and how one organizes to make that resistance meaningful. We're going to start this series with today's guest, who is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is a wise and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a moral and political philosopher as well. He has written a book entitled American Fascism. So we will ask Chris how he defines American fascism and, again, how we can fight against it to be sure that we can save our troubled democracy. Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, you covered the Christian right for 2 years and wrote a book titled American Fascists. Who were these American fascists that you were identifying? Did Christian nationalism play a part in this? Talk to us about that.
So let me go back a little bit. I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a professor, but a seminary graduate. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. So I am steeped in the Bible. I have biblical literacy. I understand the church, how it works. And in my last year at Harvard, I had a tutorial. This was with an emeritus professor named James Luther Adams. It was kind of built on the British system where he would take two final year students and work with them. And he had been in Germany at the University of Heidelberg. He was bilingual in German in 1935 and 1936. He'd actually been in the lecture hall with Heidegger giving the Nazi salute. So don't let anyone ever tell you that Heidegger didn't begin his lectures that way. And he dropped out of the university and joined the underground confessing church. That was the church run by Niemöller, Karl Barth, Albert Schweitzer. They called out the traditional mainstream church for not denouncing fascism, but they also watched the rise of the so-called German Christian church, which was pro-Nazi. And Adams, so this was in the early 1980s, saw in the rise of the Christian right, Christian nationalism in the United States, echoes of that so-called German Christian church, which was fascist, which had the Nazi flag on one side of the altar and the German flag on the other, or the Christian flag or whatever it was. So he was the first person to call these people Christian fascists. He was 80 years old when I had him, and I remember him saying to me that when we were his age, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. These are heretics. These are people who have sacralized the worst elements of white supremacy, American capitalism,